This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me tonight are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
This episode is being released in the lead up for this year's Fighting Spirit Film Festival, which is being held on the 11th and 12th of September at the Stratford Picture House. I believe, Rich, this is its sixth year. It's its third year at the Picture House.
Yeah, I think 2017 they started.
It's quite
well established now.
It is, yeah. It started off, I think the first year it was at Docklands, you know, the dome in Docklands, and then moved over to Eastgate, I think it was, for the second year, and then it became a two-day event, sort of found its home at Stratford. It's been great, and, there's been a couple of offshoots, like the premieres for Accident Man and Avengement. With Mr. Atkins in attendance. So as a tribute, this episode is all about martial arts. We're going to be kicking off with The Paper Tigers, which is getting its UK premiere at the festival. Then we have Notorious Nick. I can't wait to talk about that one. Then we have Yakuza Princess. Our short shot is Fight to Win. And we're going to round off with a bit of classic Bodo Young in Shoot Fighter in our DTV throwback. And as a special bonus, we are going to have an interview with Will Blake, who is one of the Fighting Spirit Film Festival's programmers. You will find that interview at the end of the episode. So, without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review, then, is The Paper Tigers. Danny, Hing, and Jin were the pupils of a renowned kung fu master as teenagers until an unfortunate event pushed them apart. Now, decades later, with their training a distant memory, the trio regroup when they discover that their sifu has been murdered. I'm going to kick this straight over to Steve because I want to keep my paper dry. I'm going to keep my powder dry for a second. Steve, what did you make of The Paper Tigers?
This is actually quite enjoyable. Not what I thought it was going to be, because it's more comedic-based as well. The older guys getting beat up by the younger guys type thing. It starts off with like a throwback to, VHS-like recording that they've done. And, these three lads walking around, cock of the walk, and, beating the shit out of everyone that they can, and then it just changes and, how they've drifted apart and grown up and not reached the full potential, shall we say, and things like that. And then it has a lot of more of a comedic slant on it, really. But it is enjoyable. I especially liked, is it Andy Wu?
Yeah.
Is it Elaine Yu? Sorry.
Yes, as Danny, yeah.
Yeah, Danny, I thought he was phenomenal. There's a scene where he's in the car talking to his son near the end of the film. And that performance, yeah. Like you say, hit you right in the feels. I thought he was absolutely cracking in that scene. And I think the only thing that laid down a bit was the scripts. I think the scripts could have been a bit tighter. Another draft of it, I think it would have tightened it up really well. But apart from that, I enjoy this one a lot.
Awesome. Rich?
Yeah, I don't think you could get a more perfect film to be opening the Fighting Spirit Film Festival. I mean, this is the most well-suited film that they've had so far, I think. I mean, it's about, it's a lively, popular crowd pleaser. It's fully engaged with its subject matter. It is a martial arts film through and through. The core of the subject. I mean, it's a traditional, not, I would say revenge, but it's not really revenge. It's more investigative. But, it's like it's the death of the master is the inciting event, and it follows a sort of familiar path, but it's much more of a middle-aged take on that, it's got a bit more of a Rocky Balboa-ish sort of angle to it, you know, the older guys, you know, trying to recapture former glories kind of thing, and, you know, can they face off against younger and, you know, potentially better opponents, and obviously the whole feel-good kind of factor. Ron Yuan's the best thing in the movie. I think he's the real heart of the film.
Yeah.
Alan I'll get his name wrong. He's the lead. He's very much the lead. I've not seen him in anything before, I don't think. He's not an action movie or martial arts movies guy generally, I don't think. I've had a look at some of his filmography and I haven't really seen much of it, but it seems much more dramatic. But he seemed to equip himself very well in the action scenes. I didn't see like he was getting excessively doubled or anything.
No.
And then you've got Michael Shannon Jenkins, I think, is from Undisputed 3.
Yep.
Who's again not who you would expect necessarily to be cast in this particular group. So I think the casting's really interesting. It's great we've got the Marshall Club guys in there.
Yes,
they've also got their own association with Fighting Spirit. They've did like a there was like a short of theirs showed at the festival a few years ago, and so it's just a lot of it is. It's got drama, but it's, you know, mainly a comedy. It's mainly a comedy. It's like comedy drama. It's like an indie. It's got kind of an indie feel to it, but it's very mainstream. So yeah, I really liked it a lot.
Yeah, this works a lot for me, for sure. Great performances, as you said. The humour in it comes across very well as the sort of feeling of things left undone in your past, you know, the decisions that you make that can't be undone sort of thing, which has a lot of pathos to it. But then you got this sort of procedural bit where they're sort of trying to track down, who killed their master. There's that great scene where they go to this gym. They're listening out for the sound of a kick against the kick pads. And when you do, you know straight away exactly what it is they mean when you hear it. You know, because it does just sound so different to everything else you sort of come across. One guy you didn't mention is Matthew Page, who plays Carter, the sort of American guy trying to be Chinese, who is a disciple of a rival master. Now he plays Master Ken in the YouTube videos Enter the Dojo.
I've not seen them.
They're brilliant. They're definitely worth checking out. Really, really funny. One in particular with Cynthia Rothrock. I highly recommend. He's got like a stooge guy who sort of works with him, who takes a lot of punishment, basically. But it is very funny, you know, his stuff. So he knows his stuff as well. And I just love the whole feel of it, really. It just really, really works. And especially, you know, that sort of the epilogue when, you know, they're kind of sort of making amends for, what's the word I'm looking for? For ignoring their heritage, shall we say, you know, for ignoring everything they've done in the past.
Well, they've gone off the path, exactly. Haven't they? I mean, they've been raised, you know, the master has taught them these values and everything, and they've just kind of walked off the path. You know, they've become completely estranged from their master, who, by the way, is played by Roger Yuan, who's Ron Yuan's brother. And they're both big in that. I mean, if those names aren't recognisable, you're probably not somebody who's well into your 90s 80s, action movies.
Eighties, nineties, 2000s.
2000s. You know, they're both working,
seriously in the business.
Very solid careers. You know, but big, well known names.
Yeah, both in front and behind the camera.
Absolutely. I think Ron Yuan directed one of the Step Up films, I think, recently. I'll be honest, I occasionally get the two guys confused. So
yes, but, I must admit, so do I.
But they're very different looking. You watch this movie. I mean, in Ron's character here, he's got like a wig on and stuff, and that's kind of something that forms part of the comedy that comes out in one or two of the scenes. And yeah, there's lots of, I don't know, the it's low budget, but it's it you know, it's like a good quality indie movie rather than a. It's not a cheap, money made like martial arts movie. It feels more like an indie, you know, movie that's used at budget. I mean, the only scene that feels particularly low budget, I would say, is probably the funeral scene, because it's just got like white sheets hanging and stuff. I mean, maybe that's how it would be, but it does seem like a bit of a low budget scene to have put together.
Yeah,
especially when there's supposed to be quite a few people coming.
Yeah, the funeral scene. So made me quite excited, because that was the moment that the Marshall Club guys turned up. You know, so Brian Lee and Andy Lee, and I instantly recognised them. I was like, "Holy shit!" You know, it's those guys.
Well, Andy Lee was in the director, Kwok Wo Tran, in a short film that he made previously called The Challenger, which I haven't seen yet. But Andy Lee was in that, and Andy Lee's himself, he's on the rise now with becoming a featured character in the Marvel Universe and such. So you know, this is like their year, really. I mean, you know, they've got this, and you know, this film has done really well domestically, and hopefully will do just as well over here.
Yeah, absolutely. All the better for them. You know, I'd sort of really gunning for these guys to you know, have a success on screen.
I was a bit disappointed they kind of exit the film quite early.
A little bit.
It's like, because they kind of, they have their bit and then they build on that, and there's a big long fight sequence, you know, between the two factions. And at the conclusion of that, the story moves on and we don't really see those guys again. So that was a bit of a shame. But it's all to, you know, the structure of the film is actually really good, because you get it is satisfying, you know, in the content of the martial arts action sequences as well. They kind of, you get to one step and then, okay, here's a big set piece kind of thing. You move on the story a bit, you get another bit, which is like you have a whole bit with who's the guy, the guy you just mentioned, the dojo guy.
Carter.
So Carter, so that the antagonistic character, they have kind of a big set piece sort of sequence with him, and then we've got the final part of the film where there's a bigger threat to come up against. So I think it's really well put together, I think it feels unique. You know, it's not doing anything that nobody else has done, or you know, hasn't been done before. But the way it's been made, the way it's put together, feels fresh and different. And not just for martial arts fans. I think, you know, I was quite happy watching this with my other half, who's not interested in action films or martial arts films at all, you know, because it's got that heart and, you know, the whole thing about the father-son
comedy,
relationship and everything. Yeah. They don't dwell on stuff too much. They do kind of move away from it. I mean, at the beginning of the film, Alan's character, or Danny, is it Danny's
Danny,
the lead guy?
He's a real
at the start. I mean, he parks his car in the way, then when he comes back, he doesn't apologize to anyone or ever. He just sort of he's just a bit arrogant about the whole thing, and like he's as if he that has the reason to be or something. And so you know, you just don't really warm to him at all. And I was like, well, the film's gonna have to.
It's struggling. It's
gonna work with
me. Almost like the death in the previous episode, you know. It's like, you know, he needs to redeem himself pretty quickly to get the audience on board, because otherwise he's a bit of a dick.
But yeah, so I think for me, Ron, I mean, Michael Shannon Jenkins is really good, but he's kind of he is more of the third wheel. For me, Ron Yuan's character is the one I sort of gravitate to. I mean, he's kind of instigates.
He's the glue he's bringing them together.
He's the guy getting the band back together. You know, that's the role he serves. But he has quite a couple. He has like one or two quite powerful scene, you know, dramatic scenes of his own as well.
Yeah, it is interesting the way this film marries. You know, there are classic kung fu movie themes here, You know, he got the, you know, the master killed by his student using his own, you know, secret sort of strike, you know, the secret death strike, whatever it was, you know, which is, you know, pure Shaw Brothers stuff, basically. But then, you know, at the same time, you have, you know, as you say, you know, this comedy about these three bumbling middle-aged people trying to relive their glory days as martial arts experts, you know, and it's interesting. So as the film goes on, you can see the rust breaking off, sort of thing, and, you know, their sort of spirit sort of starting to shine through underneath. So yeah, this is a class film. So how are we going to score it? So Steve,
I'm going to go 7.
Mm-hmm. Rich,
I'm going to go for an 8.
Yeah, I'm joining Rich on an 8 for this one. This is very good indeed. Please definitely, check it out.
Definitely lives up to the hype, I would say.
Yeah, this is the thing, because on Twitter and Facebook, you know, a lot of my sort of colleagues and, you know, other sort of film critics, especially ones based in the States, have been going on about this film for ages. And it's like, one day it's going to get here. You know, and here it is, finally. So yeah, this film is being shown at the Fighting Spirit Film Festival. So we're going to see it on the big screen as well, which is going to be interesting. It is going to be really different, I think, to see this film with an audience, Rich.
Absolutely. I think it's going to, you know, you could. I was just watching it and I was just thinking that bit's going to play really well. That bit's going to play really. You can just hear in advance the audience laughter, I think. And so if anyone is able to, you know, I'm sure, you know, worth checking the Fighting Spirit website, so you see if tickets are still available. It's a bit last minute, but and if you can get there, great. If you can't, it's out on a digital release on the 20th of September.
Absolutely. So 2 8s and a 7 for the Paper Tigers. Check it out. Our next review is Notorious Nick, the true story of Notorious Nick Newell, who fought his way to an MMA championship despite having been born with just one arm. Especially the first half of this film, guys, I was very much reminded of another film we covered not too long ago. I'm sure this one, he had the same sort of feeling of deja vu.
Next
time.
Triumph with RJ Mitt, which again dealt with a, you know, sort of a handicapped person, you know, wanting to be part of the wrestling team. So yeah, it's, you know, especially the first half sort of had a lot of the same beats, even down to, you know, his friendship with the sort of one of the other kids and things like that, and the coach. But then obviously, you know, the second half sort of deals with his adulthood, or sort of, you know, heading towards his adulthood. We get the likes of Kevin Pogolak coming in as the rather nice sort of manager slash promoter, and other things that sort of go on. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I must admit, I think it's incredibly well made. Again, we have that stupid bloody in media res bit at the beginning, but I'll forgive it because it isn't particularly long. It doesn't do anything very much apart from make you wonder if he won or lost a particular fight. But yeah, you know, this is one of those great sort of, you know, triumphing over incredible odds kind of stories. And I ate it up, I have to admit. Steve, how do you feel about this one?
Yeah, I wasn't as positive as you, shall we say. And I think literally because we watched Triumph the other week and it was just same beat. I mean, I'll be honest, I didn't realise it was a true story until the credits at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's not my, MMA isn't my thing. I've never watched a fight or, you know.
The thing is, I mean, the fights in the film are a lot more cinematic than you would actually see in an MMA match, I think.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it comes across. You know, we get footage in the credits of that, you know, the climactic match, that, you know, the real match that happened between him and I forgot the name of the guy. Was it Mitchell? But and the other thing the film does is bulk up the characters a lot, because in real life, you know, this the Mitchell guy that he fights at the end is incredibly scrawny. He looked like,
yeah,
he looked like he could sort of blow him over with a feather sort of thing. But the film.
That was the thing that threw me, because he's supposed to be a lightweight, and I'm thinking he's not a lightweight. He's built like a British shit house. You know,
He looked a lot more menacing than so the true life
version. I mean, yeah, the guy playing Nick, I thought he was really good. His mate was a bit cheesy, but you know, it's quite generic. You know what's going to happen. You know, them two are so pally.
Yeah, this is the interesting thing. I mean, I don't know about that particular character. Whether or not he was is he a narrative construct, or is he the real guy sort of thing?
I'm presuming it is, because but like I say, it's just presumption, because I really don't know. Mm. But to me, it was like, right, okay, so it was like ripping off Rocky 2 or Rocky 3. It's like, I know what's coming for you. The only one that surprised me really was actually Kevin Pollak, because he was actually seemed like an half decent promoter, not a slimy bastard who's trying to rip him off, which is what normally happens in kind of things like this. But and a couple of the crowd shots as well.
Where there's like 10 people.
Well, it's not so much that, because you can see the octagon.
Yeah.
And then they cut to like, 500 people sat around the ring. He's like, well, yeah, you're obviously not there, because the lighting and everything is just so different. You're using stock footage. And there was just a couple of cheap bits like that kind of put me off. But it wasn't, don't get me wrong, it wasn't terrible, but I think it just reminded me too much of Triumph, to be fair. And it was just like watching the same film over again that I just watched a couple of weeks ago.
Rich, how did you get on with Notorious Nick?
Yeah, it is very much like Triumph, and also the American Fighter, which was a sequel to another film about a wrestler, but it was actually the wrestler becomes an MMA. So if you put the two together, it's kind of the same thing. It's good that we've got Kevin Pollak. He's kind of the big star that they've got in there, but he's not like the guy in the corner. He's not the coach character. So he's actually in and out quite briefly, which is a bit disappointing. He's good. I mean, he's always reliable. So he's a good presence to have. But, the coach character, the actor playing the coach, wasn't as strong as maybe you'd want. This isn't Rocky. He ain't Mickey or anything, So
he's no Terrence Howard.
No, exactly. So well, if you'd had Kevin Pollak Kevin Pollak in the Terrence, in the coach kind of role, I think you'd have more of a much more impact. Mm-hmm. But I think they didn't have the money for that amount of star power, so that it's kind of ranked down a bit. The thing I liked it. The repetition, okay, that's fair enough. Going back to what you were saying about whether certain things are a construct and everything, interestingly, right at the very end, there's a very lengthy disclaimer saying, although this is based on a real person, this is not a biography, this is not a documentary. Please don't take anything in this film as being related to reality. They kind of set it up. It's that old thing of with biopics. It's like, how much do you believe? They've taken this core idea. They've used the name of the character, or whatever. It's almost like the Iron Lady with Margaret Thatcher, which everyone knows was complete fabrication. It wasn't intended to be a biographical, although people could interpret it that way easily enough. She didn't have those conditions and whatnot. But in this case, it's like, well, surely that's the story. That's the story of this guy. It was like, well, no, actually, although yes, there are, the character has his name. He has he's only got the one arm, but pretty much, and he won the fight and became the champion and stuff, but everything else is under question at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So I'm a bit disappointed by that, because I would prefer if it was more real, and it didn't have to sort of say that actually we've made a whole lot of stuff up. But you know, that's movies for you, artistic license and whatever. The thing I didn't like was the fact that they had to use an able, you know, a two-armed guy and visual effects instead of just casting an actor with one arm. I don't see any reason why they could not have done that. I'm sure there are perfectly capable actors who could play with one arm who could have played that role.
I'll be honest, I didn't get that.
I'd say the visual effects are good.
There's
a few wobbles and stuff, I think, but I do think the quality, I mean, especially considering this is quite a low budget film, I think the quality of the, I guess, you know, what they've done is they've done like a sleeve and they've done the green screen thing.
There's two things there, you know. One is they did a very good job of making it look like he only had one arm. The other thing they did really well is make it look like he could fight with only one arm. So, you know, there's no moment where you're thinking he's using a full left arm, you know, or he's thinking in a way of using a full left arm in order to fight. You know, it is literally everything he does is as if he's only got one arm, you know, one arm to the elbow. What was interesting watching the clips at the end of the film, also realize that what they've actually done is, for dramatic effect, shorten his arm even more than it is in real life.
Yes,
which was a bit strange.
And the child was a lot thinner in the film.
Yeah, but I mean,
they completely changed the they completely changed the way the child looked as well.
Yeah, okay, which is a bit, you can read into that, but. I mean, yeah.
And obviously they made him a lot more. I mean, the guy who's playing Cody Christian, who's playing Neil. I mean, he's like super. Super handsome guy. I mean, the typical old American.
Put it this way: he is from the stable that is the CW network. You know, so he's had a recurring role.
That's not surprising.
Yeah, exactly. He's had recurring roles on Teen Wolf and an American football series called All American. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so he's like, you know, part of that stable of actors, you know, young and handsome, basically.
He's really good. I mean, he plays the role really well. And I don't know if you noticed this, but you know, the film ends on a rap song.
Yeah.
That's him.
Ah, interesting.
He's a rapper as well. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have thought that, would you? Look at him. Yeah. But no, he's quite a talent. He's quite a diverse guy. So it's quite interesting. But yeah, that, I mean, I do think, you know, that grained a bit of it. You know, they spend a lot of money on visual effects or whatever when they could have just hired someone to do it. It's like the whole Hobbit thing.
Yeah, I disagree with the whole they could have just hired someone kind of thing. You know. It's a difficult decision to make, I think. I'm not going to sort of second guess the decisions sort of that went on there. But yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, it's like, well, surely in this age, you should be considering it at least, you know. Going down that route. But, you know.
Yeah, I think, you know, considering where we are now in terms of trying to have better representation.
Exactly.
It just seems a bit of an odd choice for me anyway. I mean, especially as somebody who knows, you know, because my I know somebody who's got only one arm and everything, I think if he watched it, maybe I don't know how he'd feel about it. I don't know.
I don't think it's, you know, all they do is exploitative at all or anything like that. But I think
no, it's not. It's not like blackface or anything like that. although you could argue them. That way,
you sort of mentioned about sort of the narrative not being sort of biographical, but I think there are enough touches between the two. I mean, you know, you're trying to make an entertaining film, so yes, I can imagine there's quite a bit of artistic license.
Yeah. I'm sure it happens in all of them. You know, it's just that in this case, they had this blooming long disclaimer at the bit, and I've never read anything like. Normally, it says, you know, subject and events or whatever, but this one seemed to go really out of its way to try and say we don't want you to confuse this with reality.
Yeah.
Then don't call it Notorious Nick and use the same name. They might change the character.
Well, no, because I think the character is relatively true to life. I think you know the fact that he did hire his his high school wrestling coach to be his his actual coach. Then you got sort of stuff like his parents, his estranged dad, things like that. So there might be
he let him off lightly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stuff there which is could be just there for dramatic effect. But yeah, I thought this was a solid film. I didn't mind that it was sort of treading on the toes of Triumph and American Fighter.
I did like Triumph more, I'll be honest. And again, the fact that RJ Mitty has cerebral palsy himself, that's kind of one of the more interesting things about it is, they'd actually cast a person, a talented actor with the condition for the appropriate role, and that worked really well. So maybe that's it. I don't know. And also, I think they had a bit bigger of a budget. This one's quite a lower budget. I mean, if you compare the crowd scenes, the fight kind of scene. If you compare those to what we get when we're going to talk about Shoot Fighter later, it's just completely different. It's like it's almost like they had fortunes back then because there's massive crowds and
the wardrobe budget for a start,
But anyway,
scores.
We're going to score. Yeah.
Well, I think this is a solid 7. So, Steve,
I'm going to go 6.
Mm-hmm. And Rich.
I still think it's worth seeing. I still like it. I think it's worth a 7.
2 7s and a 6 for Notorious Nick. Go check it out. Our next review is Yakuza Princess. On her 21st birthday, Akimi, a young woman working as a shop assistant in Sao Paulo, Brazil, discovers the truth behind her Yakuza heritage, but may not live long enough to do anything about it. This film confused me right at the start. I'm thinking Yakuza Princess in Brazil? Because all the producers, all the production companies coming up are all sort of like linked to Sao Paulo and Brazil. I'm thinking, what? But yes, this film is mostly set in Sao Paulo, with a few little sojourns across to Okinawa. I thoroughly enjoyed this. It's a bit long than it needs to be, but it's nice and violent. It has a bit of a slow start. We have two different storylines going on right at the beginning. We've got this young girl, Akimi, sort of trying to find a way in life in Sao Paulo. She recently lost her grandfather, who had been mugged and died in a mugging. And at the same time, we got this guy in hospital who's lost his memory with some sort of serious facial wounds and things. He doesn't know who he is or what he is or where he's going. But he knows he has something to do with this samurai sword, and off he goes. Yeah, I just love this. It's it's dark, it's moody, and very, very violent. Steve, what did you make of it?
It's dark, it's moody, it's very, very violent. I was a bit confused, to be fair. I weren't exactly sure what was going on, but I enjoyed it. It's not one of the it's balls to the wall, basically. There's heads flying, arms flying, everything like that. Shot really well. Scene where some guys in the lift and they're going up the lift shaft running round.
Yeah.
That I thought was really, really, really well shot.
I noted that as well, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it looked beautiful. I mean, the way the moves I thought were great, the choreography was great. It's just a bit confusing, but I really enjoyed it for what it was. It was just balls to the wall, let's just go for it. And there wasn't any holding back, and that's what I really enjoyed about it. The only thing was, did he really have to get his cock out?
Oh, I'll tell you what.
You know what I mean?
Yes. The funny thing is, last weekend we were watching Gogglebox, and they were talking about this TV series called Sex Life, which is on.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
You heard about the scene about I'm talking scene. About?
I've
yeah,
it. I've oh, heard about it.
Jesus
I've not seen
Christ!
It.
Yeah, they showed that scene in the showers at the gym. It's so funny. It really is.
I was just like, there's no need for it. Just I don't know. He's like, well, you know what, lads. I'm gonna rock out and my cock out on this one. Fuck off. I'm having it. I'm just gonna do it. It just seemed
it is funny.
Yeah. I was just sat there like, nah, I'm not here for this. But no, it was really good. It was a really good film. Best I've seen for a while.
In which case I don't recommend the film The Samurai to you, or Der Samurai, the German film. Because it basically ends with this. Basically, the most erect penis you've ever seen.
Even worse than the one in Rock?
Yeah, even worse than that.
Fair enough.
Anyway, enough about penises. Rich, what did you make of Yakuza Princess?
It's got a very distinctive style. It's got the Brazilian setting, as you say. It turns out it's a Brazilian production. So that's why it's all, I mean, even the stuff in Japan was probably shot in Brazil, I presume, but made in English. But it's all, you know, the cinematography is like turquoises and pinks and stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's definitely of its time.
Quite dark. Yeah. It's got this very particular style. Made me think of much lower budget films, but like Michael Oblowitz's Out for a Kill with Steven Seagal, which is a really messy film. But it's got some quite crazy cinematography in that sort of color scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of going for that Japanesey kind of tone. But the or comic book, you know, comic book kind of thing, because this is based on a graphic novel. Now the thing was, John, this is the Yakuza Princess of the title, played by Masumi. Just that name. I don't know much about her. But the headliner is Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. It seems at times that I felt like he was just kind of shoehorned in there as like a name star and, you know, the white, you know, a recognizable white male star for the movie.
Not really that recognizable, considering his face is covered for a lot of it. And then,
just to sidetrack to that, I think the scars on his face, the makeup effects are fantastic. Looks really, really good.
Very
good. Very great character work. You know, that really sort of, it could have looked rubbish, but it just looks really authentic and you know, very nice.
He's sort of bulked up a bit as well, isn't he?
I mean, we saw him in Edge of the World recently. He gets around. I mean, he's done loads of movies all over the place, but he's not really an action-y guy. But, you know, you put him in these kind of, put him in anything and he kind of adapts himself to it. You know, Velvet Goldmine was kind of his big breakthrough. And was he in that as well? He's done loads of stuff. And so him in this, who reminded me of actually of Dan Stevens in The Guest.
Yeah.
He's kind of got this kind of Terminator kind of quality. Now, going back to the scene that you mentioned earlier, I mean, that is the scene of the Terminator, you know, Arnie as the Terminator arriving and going, I want your clothes, your boots and your motorcycle.
That's true.
Except Myers has got the confidence to have a rather lengthy strut as he makes his way towards the clothes that he wants to obtain. And, so that was quite striking. But the interesting thing is, although it seems like, you know, she's the main character and he's kind of, you know, almost redundant for the most part, the graphic novel is called Samurai Shiro and his character is Shiro. So so he is kind of the main character, as far as I can tell, if you base it on the title, you know, he's kind of an integral character or the main character from the graphic novel itself. So they've changed in calling it Yakuza Princess. They kind of spun it to focus on her, whereas is originally that, I presume it wasn't.
Okay. Is that not the comic book that her mate gives her?
Yeah.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Might be.
I'm sure it's called that.
Yeah, quite possibly, but that's probably like a little reference and sort of playful thing they've thrown in there. I didn't take notice of that because I didn't actually realise until the end credits that it was based on a graphic novel. So that's quite interesting, is that it's got these two sides to it. It's like it's her story, but it's also his story. But for me, his story felt more tacked on, more redundant. You know, it kind of becomes that white guy protecting the young girl who's going to discover there's something really special about her kind of thing, you know, whether it's Safe or, you know, or I don't know, any other film about somebody protecting a kid or protecting a woman or something. You know, it's got that kind of formula to it. But the film is more dramatic and it does throw more, you know, there's a sort of supernatural, sort of mystical element to it that's not overplayed, but it's kind of hinted at and, you know, if not actually the case, it's culturally very important to them and seems to have some resonance. So she's led to a grave site where she finds some documentation and stuff that sort of helps her in that final part or the almost final part of her journey to, you know, discovering her identity and everything. The sword obviously is the main thing, and there's a Kill Bill element, you know, sort of makes you think of, you know, all those sort of old style movies that Kill Bill was influenced by. The sword play, yes, very violent, very, very impactful in quite a lot of scenes. Not just the sword play, the bit where Jonathan Rhys-Meyers smacks the guy's head through a cabinet in the antique shop was amazing. It was so sudden and so intense. That was really good. But the sword play, you know, the blood and guts stuff, too much CGI for me. I mean, it was all CGI, and the director kept doing this, you know, that little trick that they do when you know blood goes onto the camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, they play that sort of thing, which has obviously all been done artificially, but they do it for like a stylistic touch. But he does it like four times, and I didn't think. And they're also, I don't know if I'm thinking of the wrong film, but wasn't there a lot of like lens flare and stuff in this? I might be thinking of a different film. But that kind of thing was a bit jarring. You know, that is kind of the path for the course with a lot of the, you know, whether it's Ninja Assassin or what was the film I'm thinking of? Not Lady Bluff, Blood, the Last Vampire, I think, you know, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting film. I didn't love it. I wasn't massively fond of it, but I do think it's got a very kind of distinctive, you know, look and feel to it that makes it kind of worth watching. I did think Jonathan Rhys-Meyers was good in that, you know, his character at times gets to do limited things, but he is quite an intense presence, and say there is that sort of Dan Stevens kind of the guest kind of feature to him. Masumi, who I wasn't familiar with, did really well. There's nice character growth for her, and the supporting cast is quite good. Oh, another thing to mention is a lot of it's actually in Japanese, but then there's some scenes where Japanese people are talking English to each other, which I thought was a bit strange, but I would say the majority of the film is in Japanese. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it's all subtitled and stuff, which has reminded me of the Steven Seagal film Into the Sun, where they took kind of a similar approach.
A couple of things I want to mention. One is early on in the film, Masumi's character sort of gets accosted by these three fuck-ups. The guy with the bleached blonde hair, you know. And I have to admit,
they underestimate her.
Well, it's one of the things I love is you know, people being too big for their own boots. That's not the right expression. But, you know, so full of themselves and getting taken down a peg or two, you know, because they underestimate the person they're going up against. When you make those people sort of totally irredeemable misogynists, who are going to get beaten up by, you know, the very woman that they're looking to rape, etc. You know, get the popcorn out, as far as I'm concerned. I love seeing people like that getting the shit kicked out of them.
What was interesting about those guys, though, is you think they're just guys in the bar, you know, causing trouble with her, but actually they're not.
That case is really serious, isn't it? It's not just a case of getting messed around with. It gets very serious.
No, I mean, but they work for the bad guys. They're part of the whole thing.
Mm. Yeah.
So they because they return later, don't they?
Well, they come after again. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they work for the.
I thought it was just after her, basically. Just
oh, really? Maybe I misunderstood something there. I could have. Yeah. That's how I took it, anyway.
No, I think they're just assholes.
But they were led in by the. The guy, weren't they?
No, they chased her in. They were in a van or something. They sort of saw her in the street and chased her to a apartment and broke in.
Yeah, I think you might be right there.
Okay. I took that completely different way.
It was more opportunistic than the way you're suggesting.
But, yeah, no, I thought they were working for the rival, the bad guy who's trying to kill her, essentially.
No, it was just some other guys who want to kill her. Maybe do some other stuff beforehand. So that was, a really cool scene. That leads into what Steve was alluding to, that sort of chase up the stairwell while the cameraman is on top of the lift, basically. Yeah. So they're running round the lift shaft, going up the stairs while he's sort of panning around. It was a really, really cool shot. But the other bit I want to mention is when Akimi and Shiro, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' character, go to that graveyard place. Jonathan Rhys-Meyers' character, Shiro, is basically left with these two old samurai guys, or these two old Yakuza guys,
yeah,
sort of drinking sake. And that scene really felt very much like something from De Palma. It had that sort of... It's the quiet before the storm moment. Where you're sort of being lulled into this sort of false sense of security. And you're watching it and you're just waiting for that other shoe to drop because you know something is going to fuck up or something really bad is going to happen. And I think something does, but it's off screen because the next thing you see is him being dragged away. It's a really cool moment. Really, really enjoyed it. I really like this. So I'm giving this a 7 out of 10. Steve?
Yep, I'll go with 7.
And Rich?
Yeah, I think definitely a 7.
Now, Rich, where is this being released? Is this coming out on digital only, or is it getting a physical release?
That's a good question. It is coming out from Signature Entertainment, and I will just find out if it's coming, because I think it's digital only. But I will
check. Yeah, I had a quick look on Amazon before we start recording, and I couldn't see a release for it.
Yeah, so it's being released digital only from Signature Entertainment, and it will be out next week.
Yep, so 3.7s for Yakuza Princess. Check it out on digital. Our short shot this week is Fight to Win. In order to save a young man's life, his own antibodies duke it out with the coronavirus on the streets of Sao Paulo. So, our second visit to Sao Paulo, it's like a double-decker bus, Rich,
Yeah, that was not intended at all. That was complete coincidence.
You wait ages and ages.
How many coincidences?
Yeah. You wait ages and ages for a film set in Sao Paulo, and what happens? Two come along at once. So, this is, it's fun. It's a neat idea. I think some of the choreography, some of the fight scenes, there's a lot of air between the, the foot and the target, shall we say. There's a lot of, sort of forced perspective to make it look like, they're actually sort of making contact when, unfortunately, it's a bit clear they're not. But it's fun. It's a neat idea. I dug it. Steve, what do you think of this one?
Yeah, I wasn't too impressed with this, to be fair. It didn't help that it wasn't subtitled. The one that I watched, I don't know if that was an issue with it. Just when I watched it on YouTube or not.
Yeah, you can put subtitles on it, but they are tiny.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it depends on your settings. I mean, I had the subtitles on and they were fine on mine. I think it's just all to do with your own sets of equipment and stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to turn the closed captions. You have to turn on.
Also, it kind of... What, you know, they throw a punch to be in a car park, and the next punch would be in a park or up a building. It just didn't. It didn't flow with me. It just it was very bitter, and like you were saying, you know, it just seemed like a lot of it wasn't landing, and obviously very, very cheaply made, and it just didn't grab me this one at all.
So without the subtitles, did you actually understand what was going on?
I presumed he was fighting a virus because there was that little flash on his face.
Yeah.
So I kind of guessed that, and obviously you can see him like lying down in his flat, and then it kicks off. But yeah, like you say, it just didn't seem to land any punches or anything like that, and just the moving round it just kind of annoyed me for some reason. I honestly thought they caught up at first. Because he started off, you know, like a concrete car park, and when he landed, he was on grass. I'm like, hang on a minute, that's not right. And then obviously it carried on; it's changing all the time. But yeah, I wasn't too impressed with this one at all.
I personally didn't mind that sort of changing of scenery. You know, once you're on board, the fact that this is like, you know, an imagined fight between, you know, the guy's sort of antibodies against things. So yeah, I could go with it sort of flowing from one place to another. How about you, Rich? Did you go with the flow on this one?
Yeah, I think we've seen, I can't think of examples, but I think we've seen examples of, you know, where an action scene is representing an internal battle of some kind. Usually it's like, something that's on the mind rather than actually being dealing with a physical, you know, ailment. I think, you know, this is one of about 30 short films that are part of this year's Fighting Spirit Film Festival short film lineup, which is in two parts. They showed some on the Saturday and some on the Sunday. I think this is an interesting one in that it's very it's very contemporary, it's very of the moment, you know, that it's not the only film I think in the lineup. We haven't seen them all, by the way. We're going to be seeing most of them at the festival, but I think there's another one that's sort of set a quarantine themed story and everything, so I thought that was interesting about it is low budget. I didn't have a problem with the fight choreography. I didn't really notice all the same things that some of the things you guys picked up on. The changing in locations and everything, you know, the playfulness, I didn't have a problem with that. We've seen, there was one, a previous Fighting Spirit that we saw, I believe, where it was all about time or something. And, you know, you might remember this one, Mike, where the guy's sort of fighting his way up a tower or something.
Yeah, that was really surreal, that one. Yeah.
And it was all to do with basically a guy waiting to go for a job interview or something.
That's right.
So so that's kind of the stuff that was coming to mind. But so it's fine. It's interesting. I think we're going to see films that are a lot better than this at the festival, but this was an interesting sort of taster of what's to come. There's not really any story or anything, so there's not really much more to say apart from that, to be honest.
No, that's right. So that is Fight to Win. We'll put a link in the footnotes. Go check it out. Our DTV throwback this week is Shoot Fighter. Ruben and Nick are lifelong friends who find their relationship strained when they both get involved in an underground fighting tournament in Mexico. Little do they realize that they are being manipulated by Mr. Lee, the tournament's organizer, so that he can have another shot at defeating their Sifu, Shingo. So this is a classic from the 90s, Rich? Starring a certain Bolo Young as Shingo, not in the film very much, to be honest, but he's, you know, there in the background, sort of turning up. We've got Martin Cove as the bad guy, Mr. Lee, always a great presence to have in any film. And then we got sort of these two guys, Ruben and Nick, who, you know, they meet up. I thought they might be sort of brothers at first, but you sort of get the impression they've sort of just been good mates forever. One of them's a sort of karate champion who's about to go for this sort of big tournament, but then he sort of gets, because he's got sort of money issues, he gets lured into this this other shoot fighting tournament down in Tijuana, where he can make some easy money, and kind of gets addicted to the you know, the thrill of a real fight. It's so much so that he actually starts actively sort of going out looking for people to beat up on the street. But there's a great moment when he gets to the final, because they make a big deal of, like, yeah, once you're in the final, you can't back out and all this sort of stuff. And people are dying left, right, and center. And you can see the look on his face. He's like, oh, shit, what have I done? You know, this shit's real, I'm dead, which is a great moment. But yeah, so Steve, had you seen this before, and what did you make of it?
No, I hadn't seen it before. it's... Yeah, it's like, you know, you kickbox and Bloodsport ripoff. But then, I'll be honest, the last, when it got to the final and stuff, I just thought it just got ridiculous.
That's where it got fun, mate. That's where it got fun.
And yeah, no, it wasn't, though, was it? I mean, you know, you've got people getting the throats and the hearts ripped out and stuff like that. And it's just like, no, you've lost me now. You know, the acting was cheesy. I mean, for the first half, it was absolute. It was terrible, to be fair. You know, you've got you missed the bad guy coming into the dressing room, just winding him up, and even is it Miriam Diabo?
Miriam Diabo, yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. She was awful. The other girlfriend was absolutely terrible.
She was just wandering along the street one day, and they said, "Do you want to be in a film?" I think,
yeah, you know. She couldn't act her way out of a paper bag, and. Yeah, no, it was too cheesy and ridiculous for me, this one. It really was.
Ah, oh, it's a shame. You know,
as soon as the throat got ripped out, I was like, nope, oh, that's it, I'm out. And then then the heart, no.
The heart rate was quite
amazing. Yeah, that's what I mean, though. That's not what the kind of thing I want from this kind of film, if you know what I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like your Bloodsport, your kickboxers, you've got that realness about it in a way that this just didn't have from start to finish, I think.
Mm-hmm. Rich, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this before.
Yep, you have this on video.
Yeah, what do you make of this this time around?
Yeah, I thought it held up very well. I mean, yeah, of course, it's very much of its time, but it's funny how. You know, you can look at these things and with the passage of time, more, you know, you get more out of them because, like, you notice more things or there's more, you know, you've got more nostalgic kind of invested in it. So you are not just revisiting the film, but then you're also thinking, well, hang on a minute. I never really realized that there's two guys from The Karate Kid in this and with not just Martin Cove, but William Zabka. Both of whom were in the Cobra Kai and now are in, obviously, the Cobra Kai series now. So they've come around again. Or Martin Cove's, I don't think his episodes have actually come out yet, but you know what I mean? He's coming back into it. Or has he? Has he been in it already? I don't watch Cobra Kai.
I've not watched it yet.
I keep meaning to.
He's back.
He is back, yeah. So both of them guys, so that's cool. Bolu Young... I remembered him, you know, being top billed, but not actually being in it very much. And, you know, which is obviously quite a familiar approach for marketing films and whatever these days, because the top billed people are Bolo Young and Miriam Diabo, basically. And Miriam Diabo has really got nothing to do. I mean, she, since, you know, this is only a couple of years after she did The Living Daylights and, you know, she just couldn't really get many roles, it seems. And in here... She, you know, she's doing an American accent, you know, fairly, you know, passable.
Mm-hmm.
But her character doesn't really have a lot to do and basically disappears after the, you know, before the final act. You know, we never see her again. That's one of the funny things about this film is there's no epilogue. It's just, it literally just goes, and that's the end. Because Bolo is kind of introduced like quite important right from the beginning. And then it's almost like one of these Steven Seagal movies these days where, you know, you introduce the main character, that character, but then we spend all the time with supporting characters, and then the top headline star comes in for the final showdown. But I thought it was great. Bolo's really, you know, he's very stoic. He doesn't really say very much. I mean, he probably doesn't speak English very well, so therefore they don't really give him many lines. He's got some Chinese dialogue, but he's just. I mean, there's scenes where they're talking to him and they're having a conversation. He just goes, or something, or just gives a gesture or something. It's quite funny. So what there is of him that I liked, but the film starts with his friend basically getting killed in the ring, death match, you know, it's death match style. And what made me laugh, you know, with the, you know, looking at this all these years later, is he knows it's going to happen and he does absolutely nothing.
There's nothing to try and avenge his death or anything. He just goes,
well, no, I mean, he doesn't try and stop it.
No. Yeah.
Just, he could have stepped in at any point. Someone could have stepped in and saved that book. Now, what I think is interesting is I'm pretty sure the guy at the start was Roger Yuan.
Yes.
Who was Sifu in Paper Tigers, who died at the start of that movie. Again, this was not planned. It's just it's just one of those weird, beautiful coincidences that we get when we're putting together these shows. So that was nice. There's loads of other people peppered through it who you recognise. Like I spotted John Barrett from To the Death. I don't know if you ever saw that one. That was, I think it was a Canon production. That one had quite a memorable theme song. And he did a few other things. He wasn't, you know, he's one of the much lower tier kickboxing movie period guys. There's that big, the really, really big guy with the long blonde hair that's sort of the balding guy. So I've seen him in a few things, but I don't know what his name is. That was nice. But so getting back to the George Ki Chung, easily recognizable. Now, Martin Cove comes in at the beginning, and I'm just thinking, and in every scene he's in, no matter, you know, when he changes his outfits, I could not stop thinking of the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. I'm almost certain that he modeled himself on the Million Dollar Man. I mean, later in the movie, he's even in this like suit with the stubble and the hair and stuff, and he just looked. I don't know if either you guys were WWF.
Yeah, I remember it.
As it would have been at the time. But so that kind of really struck me. I liked the guy. I was really surprised with William Zabka because I didn't realise he had those moves. So, you know, he was doing, you know, some really great roundhouses and stuff, which was a pleasure. Because I was just thought of him as, you know, a guy who was cast in martial arts films but couldn't do any moves. You know, maybe, you know, got doubled and stuff. But I liked him. His mate, Michael Bernardo. Bernardo, I think. Again, another guy who was around quite a lot during that time, you know, the early mid-90s. Mm-hmm. He's kind of, I don't know what happened to him, but I do remember seeing him in quite a few things then. The whole death matches thing, obviously, is great fun. That was the big thing, all the punch fighting and death matches, punch fighting, as the guys on Comeuppance Review would refer to them, as like all the kind of people standing around shaking handfuls of cash. That's how you know it's a punch fight.
That's right.
You got the training montages and stuff. Again, we got those in. There's a couple of things that were a bit like Notorious Nick. You know, these kind of conventions of the genre. So you got the training sequences, obviously.
Yep.
But then there's the scene where Michael Bernardo, the friend character, Michael Bernardo's character, who is Miriam Darbo's character's brother.
That's right.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if they were childhood friends and then he got with the sister, or it was the other, or, you know, he knew her, he got with her and then he befriended her brother. I'm not sure which way around it was. But the... he rides in on a motorcycle in a very similar fashion to the way Notorious Nick's pal rides in on a motorcycle. You know, so the, in this one, it's like a, an Electric Glide in blue. And in the other one, it's a Harley Davidson. But they both kind of make a big point of it, and they've got the music making an entrance thing, which I thought was fun. The plot, the way it unfolds, and, you know, the being seduced by the money on offer, and, you know, William Zabka kind of being the one who really loses his way. I didn't remember it that way. I thought it was going to be the... I thought he was going to be kind of... His friend was going to try and lead him astray, and then his friend was going to die, and he was going to have to avenge him. And it's, it doesn't unfold that way at all.
No, well, I was, you know, because my memory was a bit hazy as well, and I was wondering if... sort of Ruben, the blonde one, was going to end up getting killed on this circuit, and then Bernardo is going to have to get Bolo to train him so that he could take his place, you know. But no, it was even more interesting than that, as it turned out, you know. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, they kind of, the Bolo doesn't really want to go, because it's all, the whole thing is about the two friends being approached to get involved in the shoot fighting as bait to get Bolo, his character, to come so that Martin Cove can get revenge because he felt slighted by him or whatever.
Well, because his man had killed Poe, Ron Wynn's character in the beginning, they cancelled that tournament. So Martin Cove's character never got to fight Bolo.
I see.
So he felt slighted by that. You know, yes. He wanted his chance to fight him. So yeah. But yeah.
So did you enjoy? Cool, you enjoyed it as much as I did.
I did, and not only that, but Shoot Fighter 2 is also on Amazon Prime, and I've never seen that one. So I'm hoping to sort of catch that.
That was released over here as Enter the Shoot Fighter originally. Oh, I think. Right. I think so. This one's known as Shoot Fighter, also known as Shoot Fighter Fight to the Death.
Yep.
Which is a bit more of a cumbersome title. But now, did you think that was a real thing or something that they'd invented in the movie? Because I didn't know.
You know the tournament bit in Enter the Dragon?
Yeah.
You know, where Roper goes up against some other guy and then Lee goes up against O'Hara. And there's that bit where they have to sort of touch hands before striking. I thought it was that kind of thing, although it's not sort of particularly clear. You know, that's what sort of Martin Coe's character and Bolo seem to be doing at the end. So I don't know if that was a thing or not. No, I just got the impression it was just all made up like Bloodsport.
Yeah, no, I looked at it. I googled it, and it's a real thing. Shoot fighting it seems to me, you know, I love martial arts movies, but I don't know a lot about martial arts at all. This was kind of a progenitor of MMA because it was about mixing styles. So it was about you could mix particular styles, and in this case, they do things like they throw in the weapons and stuff. But I think it was particular things, and without getting up a dictionary or not dictionary, but you know, like a definition, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was. But I think the term shoot fighting or whatever, it has been like trademarked or something, and it's part of a system now, so it's not really referred to anymore, but at the time it was something that I think had been developed in the 70s as a sort of, yeah, as I interpret it, as like something that was a forerunner to what MMA has become, which makes sense. I mean, the film, they were mixing different kind of styles and stuff, so I thought that was quite interesting, because at the time, you know, it's just kind of a funny title, and you just think it doesn't really mean anything, but it actually does have more significance than I realized.
Cool. All right, we don't score the throwbacks, but we certainly recommend them, even though Steve didn't enjoy it very much. But yeah, you can find this on Amazon Prime. As I said, the sequel's there as well, if you enjoyed this. Please do check them out. Let us know what you think as well. Why not? That is the end of this particular episode as far as our reviews are concerned. So thanks to Rich and Steve for joining me, as usual, and looking at all this stuff.
No problem.
No problem. So the Fighting Spirit Film Festival, as you mentioned, is going to be on the 11th and 12th of September. Check out the website. There will be a link in the footnotes. But before we go, I'm just going to hand over to myself, where I'm going to be talking to Will Blake, who is one of the festival programmers. So take it away, Mike. Yes, so I'm sitting on the opposite side of Zoom to William Blake, who is one of the main programmers for the Fighting Spirit Film Festival. Will, welcome to the DTV Digest.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Will, let's sort of just jump straight in and find out how you got involved with this this particular festival.
So actually I came in as a fan. I came to the first year and I had seen that the festival has popped up, but what got my interest was that Drunken Master was being screened, and it was quite a rare thing actually for a classic kung fu film to be on at the cinema. So I don't think I'd been to one since probably 10 years prior to that. So when I saw the festival, I sort of looked into it and then went in, met Sue on the day, who's the founder, and it turned out we had mutual friends. So we sort of kept in touch after that. And that's how I got involved slowly.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, what was the sort of defining moment to actually get you involved in the festival as a programmer?
Well, as time went on, I mean, at that time, that was the first festival was Sue on her own, Sue Cole. And as time has gone on and we've sort of become a team, the festival slowly evolved. But at that point, there was a sort of year prior to the next one. So there was a group of us that became friends through a mutual friend. And we became this kind of chat room, I suppose, of fanatics on kung fu and movies in general. And as there was the lead up to the second festival, Sue asked, did any of us want to get involved? So, you know, we met up, and there are a few different people. We've all mostly got martial arts backgrounds, but we've all got a passion about cinema or the films themselves. And, you know, as the team sort of formed itself in a sense that everyone had their own strengths. And I ended up, you know, being sort of asked, would I like to do features? And my thing is sort of classic martial arts film. So of course, I jumped at the chance, but you know, we went from there basically.
That's awesome. So what is your background in martial arts? I mean, are you a martial artist yourself, or is it just a passion for the films?
Well, I am a martial artist, but I mean, it's come about really through the films, because I think in the West, we are not necessarily touched by the culture, especially with Kung Fu, the sort of traditional Chinese culture is not all around us. So I actually sort of entered into martial arts through loving the films. I've always been a cinema fan, but I got into Bruce Lee, especially when I first saw Enter the Dragon in the probably early 90s. Mm-hmm. And started to sort of fanatically watch the films and pick up books on Hong Kong cinema and Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan, that kind of thing. So there was a point where I was just such an avid sort of VHS watcher, and the films were really an obsession. And, you know, you get a buzz out of martial arts films, and that sort of attracted me to going, seeking out a club and, you know, starting some kung fu myself. So I did that probably about 20 years ago, and just got really into it. So for a time, I was just full on with the kung fu life. And that's something, although now I'm older and I don't have as much time to devote to martial arts, it's something that kind of stays with you.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And it fuels your passion, you know, like when you really get into the films, because, you know, there's that energy that you get from really awesome martial arts. So.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, martial arts films have had a bit of a rocky sort of, you know, it's been quite difficult to get sort of, you know, into the mainstream until something like John Wick comes along, or, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
I was wondering if you ever sort of visited Ricky Baker's shop down in Camden back in the day.
Yeah, it's funny because that side of the fandom really passed me by, I think, because in pre-internet days, unless you knew about the magazines, or you had a newsletter, or you knew someone that was visitor of the shop, or knew the Eastern Heroes brand. I mean, I used to have a lot of the Eastern Heroes releases when I first got DVD, and I think that was probably at the latter part of, you know, their sort of first peak.
As
I say, I wasn't online, so I think, you know, Screen Power you would see occasionally in shops like Forbidden Planet, and you know, I think Eastern Heroes used to get mentioned in the sort of genre books as well. Yeah. But until I started training in Kung Fu, and then I realized that everyone that was a Kung Fu was usually, you know, a film fanatic as well. I didn't really realize how much of a grapevine there was and a network of these things. So I sort of got into the VHS thing probably later than other people. I think, you know, as I said, the Bruce Lee was the sort of mid-90s, and then things like Rumble in the Bronx came shortly after that, and First Strike. And I was sort of just going to every HMV sale I could and buy tapes like mad. But yeah, it's I still look back at those days with like great affection.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was very much the same. I think, you know, something like Last Hurrah for Chivalry, you know, the final sort of half hour of that was just sort of watched continuously, you know, sort of over and over, because it's absolutely sort of amazing sort of kung fu stuff. And it's the sort of stuff you want to show your mates as well, you know.
Yes, definitely. And you kind of, even with VHS, you kind of got into a habit of skipping through the film to catch all the fights.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sort of preps you in a way for the, you know, the amount of kung fu that I've consumed, you know, through my telly over the years. Is sort of a good groundwork for the festival, because when we're looking at features, you know, we're looking for stuff obviously with awesome fights, great choreography, and great you know, on-screen persona of the leads and so on. But we really want good cinema. We want good stories. We want good, well-made films.
Yeah,
and that's, you know, become part of our criteria for selecting stuff. Is if we're just going for show real action, sometimes that doesn't deliver on the rest of the film. And you really, you know, you want to put on a film that you would want to go and see yourself, you know? Yeah. So you kind of, when you're into the kind of really, you could say the sort of classic era stuff, you set the bar quite high for action and shoot, you know, cinematography and editing and stuff like that. But we don't want just, you know, great fights. We want great films as well. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah, and as I seem to remember, you know, right from the off, one of the sort of the criteria, the agenda, if you will, for the festival is to try and make sort of martial arts films and martial arts in general as accessible as possible. So it wasn't the case of like just catering to the, you know, the hardcore old school crowd, but sort of, you know, to sort of show the, you know, how it's influenced the mainstream and, you know, bring in foreign films and things. I mean, you showed you had a like remastered version of The Karate Kid. And believe it or not, I'd never seen it before. I'd never seen it as, you know, when I was growing up and when it came out. So that was the first time I'd seen it, which is quite amazing. It was great to see it on the big screen. This year we've got The Paper Tigers, which we've reviewed on this particular episode, actually, so people listening to this should have heard what we've got to say about it. It's going to be a great crowd pleaser, I think, that particular one. I think it's going to go down really well. So that, and sort of the main feature for the Sunday is Armor of God, which unfortunately I'm going to miss. But unfortunately I'll be travelling back to Nottingham, which is where
I mean, I'm not going to say Armor of God is a classic. I'm not going to say it's the best part of the festival, though. So, you know, we have actually got, I think, a really strong features lineup this year.
Yeah.
Every year is different. Every year it feels like we've topped the previous events. I mean, you mentioned sort of accessibility, and one of the things when the festival started, the first year in terms of features, we had, this is prior to me joining, but we had Drunken Master, which is your classic, Ip Man 3 is your contemporary film, And then I think it was Kung Fu Panda, or maybe one
That's right.
So, you know, you're catering for, you know, the hardcore fans, someone that wants to see something new or that they've recently heard of, say, and then a family film. And, you know, part of our thing is, you know, inspiring people through martial arts. So we want, you know, we would love families to come and younger people to come and see stuff on the screen, like, you know, may have been inspired as a kid by seeing something like Karate Kid and, you know, think about taking up martial arts. So, absolutely, you know, that's something we want to do, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, the lineup this year, I think, is especially strong because we've got a feature documentary for the first time, which is the story of Pat Morita's life, which is absolutely fascinating. And it's a really well-made documentary as well. And I learned a considerable amount about him that I didn't know. And, you know, again, we've got the classic, we've got Armor of God, but we've also got Kung Fu Warrior, which is a Vietnamese film starring Andy Long. We've got The Paper Tigers, which again is American, but it's sort of calls back to the classic Kung Fu films as well.
Oh, absolutely, you know,
It's got a bit of, you know, classic Hong Kong cinema about it. Again, it's got a really strong cast. It's got, I mean, Ron Yuan is incredible in that film. He's so funny as well. Like I've seen him over the years in so many sort of DTV gems. And he's the guy that was in all those like PM Entertainment films and stuff going back in the day. Yeah. And his brother as well, you know, I've seen, he's had some really prominent roles, but I've definitely never seen Ron doing comedy the way he does. And the film is, you know, it's a great sort of buddy movie as well as a martial arts story. So.
Yeah. And it's great to see, you know, the Marshall Club guys involved in that film as well.
Exactly.
I mean, we're big fans of their work. And as soon as they walked into the funeral, it's like, oh my God,
And they're great guys, obviously, and they do so much online, you know, like they're literally all over the web. And I've been thinking for quite a time, like, when are these guys going to break into cinema? You know, like, when are we going to start to see? And I know they do stunt work anyway. I think Andy Lay is connected to Shang-Chi. So, you know, they are working in Hollywood, but, you know, that's a really nice thing. And if you enjoyed that, you'll enjoy Kung Fu Warrior, because they're heavily involved in that as well. Awesome. So that's a really nice one too.
Cool. So, I mean, how do you go about actually sourcing the films themselves? How do you convince the sort of distributors to allow you to show them?
Yeah, well, that's always a challenge. You know, we're already, you know, we're gearing up for this festival and we're already looking at what to show next. So, you know, our sort of senses are sort of up and looking for stuff constantly. You know, this like Donnie Yen's Raging Fire is you know, it's going to come out in Asia. You've got New York Ninja, which there's a trailer for that. The drop looked fantastic. And there's a new Hong Kong stuntman film, documentary that looks incredible. And, you know, we see things which we think deserve the kind of platform, and that's one way. Other ways is, you know, obviously working with our filmmakers that were involved in the festival. Sometimes they move on from a short film and they, you know, they're working in the industry, so sometimes we're drawn to a project because of people that we've heard about or have met who are in it's kind of a lot of scouring IMDb and Hong Kong movie database and stuff like that to try and follow what, you know, martial arts actors or choreographers, directors are doing. But yeah, it's kind of keeping an eye out for the buzz. Cool. And then in terms of getting labels on board, it can be really hard work. I mean, one of the things in the UK is that the budgets aren't great. You know, they're obviously trying to acquire films, but they might not have extra marketing budget or be able to devote time even to working with us for a screening. So sometimes you have to convince a label that it is worth their time. Generally speaking, I mean, we've always had good feedback from our events. So, you know, generally speaking, once they're involved and they see how the festival works, they're, you know, so for example, 88 Films, we did Dragons Forever with.
That was awesome. That was awesome to see that on a big screen.
Yeah, and that was incredible because it was a, you know, stellar remaster anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, redone subs and stuff like that. But I'd never seen, for me personally, I've never seen a classic film like that. That was such a good screening to be involved in and to go to. And then, you know, we've worked closely with them since. I've done a couple of extras for them where I've written some material for the Blu-ray booklets and things like that. Cool. And then as, you know, so again, if you're working closely with a label, sometimes you get in on, you know, what their upcoming slate is. And, you know, we're all about timing. So this festival now is a couple of months ahead, pretty much, of the Blu-ray release of Armor of God. So we can get a kind of exclusive on the new remastered print. And, you know, it's a virtuous circle. You know, we get people interested through the name and the label, and then they hopefully get a higher profile release when it comes out. So, you know, that's the sort of merit, I think, of labels being involved in the festival.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so there's a lot of groundwork. I mean, the hardest part, I think, aside from getting, you know, that getting over that kind of financial hurdle that some companies will have, is also the sourcing rights for older films. You know, I mean, a lot of stuff in Hong Kong, your main distributors are Fortune Star for most of the Golden Harvest catalogue, or Celestial for Shaw Brothers. And if it's not, pretty much, if it's not in those two, it's very, very hard to get rights to show anything. So, you know, sometimes there are films which are, for example, when Drunken Master was screened, that was Sony. So, you know, that there are bigger companies that have, international companies that have UK rights.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of homework as well that's done.
Let's switch over to the short programme, which, you know, here at the DTV Digest, we're very keen on, because, you know, we do our little bit to sort of promote shorts. Rich has been posting, he's been tweeting a new film every week that has been shown at a previous iteration of the festival. And I know that, I mean, you know, this festival has literally gone from strength to strength. You know, it was... you know, from the first 2 years, it was a one-day event, and now it's a, you know, it is a full program of 2 days. And you must be getting so many shorts sent to you, you know, being submitted. Yes. I think 2 years ago, I think Sue said it was something like 90.
It could well have been. Yeah. I think when we first, because now we use a platform called Film Freeway, which a lot of festivals use. So when the kind of when the entry gate is open, as it were, we've got this portal where filmmakers can go to. The first year we did that, we just got tons of entries. And a lot of it was because people are just, you know, they're seeing a brief outline for the festival, but they were just submitting everything. So we actually got such a deluge of releases. There was a lot of material to go through. I mean, an average year, if we're looking at 50 or 60 shorts, we might have 5 or 6 hours content or more. So there's a lot to go through.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because, you know, it isn't a short, you know, the actual sort of program itself is about two to three hours, I think.
Yeah.
On each day.
It can be longer. With the 2 days, you're looking at 2 hours plus per day. Yeah. But I mean, the quality of entry that we've had, it just keeps on amazing us. As I say, when we opened up online like that, we actually found we got too many things that weren't, you know, applicable. So what we had to do was we put in a small entry fee, which was like $2, and it was literally just as a formality. And as soon as we did that, we pretty much only got genuine
entries. Yeah.
So that kind of cut out a lot of our work of sifting through the stuff and letting them know it wasn't for us. So now we have, you know, the process is basically that, whereas myself and Sue are involved in features, everyone in the festival group is involved in the shorts. So where we'll eventually, let's say we have sort of 50 odd entries, we'll start watching, individually, we'll all start watching them through, and then everyone gives feedback on all the films, notes, positive, negative, you know, reasons we think they definitely should be in. Sometimes it's a reason something shouldn't be in. And, you know, we'll go through the things, we'll go through, you know, all the criteria, and then we'll try and sort of weed out a few of the films where perhaps, you know, a technical aspect means that they're not quite as sharp for screening, mm-hmm. for example, or there's some content there that just doesn't kind of, you know, mesh with the brand. And we'll get it down to a kind of a really strong shortlist. Once that's done, we let everyone know they're in and they're kind of being considered, and then it goes to the judging panel, and then, you know, they get their time to go through everything, and it eventually becomes our program. And, you know, we've got some new awards and so on this year, so we keep kind of evolving how we recognize, you know, the hard work that the filmmakers are doing.
Awesome. I mean, do you have any sort of personal favorite selections from sort of the previous years?
It's really hard to say, to be honest, because we've watched hundreds of shorts. I mean, there are so many great ones, and the funniest thing is that sometimes the one that you champion the most, other people don't get. And we have actually had this where, you know, we've got a selection, and it's the beauty of doing it as a group, and the fact that you've had this kind of democratic process is that no one really has final say on what goes in. So, you know, you give your views on the merits of everything. You say which are your top things, but it's not a fight. It's not like I definitely want these in. These should override your ones or whatever. So, you know, we get such a great mix of stuff, the quality of which have been, you know, so good. And I think we've seen over the pandemic, you know, that people are still making films, which is fantastic. It might be that they're shooting on phones rather than doing it with small crews. But, you know, there's such a sort of, you know, growth of quality in terms of like what people can do with kit at home, you know, that is now sort of rivaling some movies, you know. So the quality is ever increasing. So, you know, sometimes we'll see something which has got fabulous choreography or really strong visuals. Sometimes we get a science fiction short that's, you know, got some CG in it or whatever, you know. I mean, it never ceases to amaze, like how much people put into them.
You know, just off the top of my head, so one of the ones I remember, I think from 2 years ago, and it just sort of blew everyone awake. And it was, you know, it wasn't your sort of typical short. It was sort of documentary about this woman who had joined the diplomatic corps in America, and gone to Japan, you know, for work, and got into sort of judo and other martial arts.
Yes.
And it was just really, really engrossing sort of story, you know, for sort of 20 minutes or however long it was.
Yeah.
But it was just completely different to everything else we'd seen that day, which is absolutely superb.
And that's the nice part. I mean, there's so many stories to tell in martial arts, you know, like one of the things we're looking for in features, I particularly like, you know, like good fighter stories, because everyone loves Rocky, for example, and you love to see Jackie Chan, you know, overcome the bad guy in Snake in the Eagle's Shadow or Drunken Master. You know, like it's part of martial spirit, you know, like the martial arts world, that you have these incredible fighter stories. I mean, so you get some incredible insight into people's lives and, you know, like their training journey, their martial arts journey. And it's always good to see. But with documentaries, it's sometimes there's a fine line between something that is a bona fide documentary and something which is more like a promo reel, like a self-promotion.
Sure.
So there's a couple of times where we'll watch something and it's more like you would see promoting a club or something like that online.
Right. Yeah.
And less of a documentary. So, you know, again, that's when we're sort of weeding out, because we can't possibly screen everything. Sometimes we'll have to, you know, discount something on that sort of ground. But yeah, it's the stories just keep coming.
That is awesome. I'm going to wrap it up there, Will, basically, because I don't want to over egg things, but the Fighting Spirit Film Festival takes place in the Picture House in Stratford on the 11th and 12th of September. I believe there are still tickets available.
Yes,
for both days.
Day passes and tickets are selling fast, but there are still
available. At the moment.
So, I mean, they'll be selling up to the last minute.
Absolutely, and if you don't get a chance to see, the Paper Tigers on the big screen, that is going to be brilliant. And Armor of God, I mean, you know, you're never ever going to get another chance to see Armor of God on a big screen in this country anytime soon. So please check it out. You'll find a link to the Fighting Spirits website in the footnotes. So thanks, Will, for joining me this evening.
You're welcome. It's been great.
Awesome. And for everyone listening, thanks for listening. Tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.